Hello, everyone, and welcome to Qualitative Conversations, a podcast series hosted by the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association. I'm Jessica Lester, the chair of the Qualitative Research Special Interest Group, and I'm happy to be joined today by Dr. David Carlson. Dr. Carlson will be speaking with me today about the ways in which he engages Foucault's work as a qualitative researcher and methodologist. David Carlson is an associate professor at Arizona State University, where he is a part of the Education Policy and Evaluation PhD faculty, the Learning Literacies and Technologies PhD faculty, and the Leadership and Innovation EDD faculty. He also serves as an associate editor for Education Policy Analysis Archives and is the co-editor-in-chief of Taboo Journal of Culture and Education. He also serves on the editorial board of the American Educational Research Journal. Dr. Carlson's primary areas of research include methods of teaching secondary level English, qualitative inquiry, LGBTQ studies, and queer theory. The exploration and application of theoretical perspectives drives his work. Carlson investigates the impact of specific post-humanist theories in qualitative methods, and his current interests revolve around the uses of the radical empiricism of Aaron Manning's work on notions and practices of pedagogy and the sensual curriculum. He is also working on art, philosophy, and literature to produce seductive aspects of research. The work of Gilbert Simondon is seminal in his current study. He continues to work with Foucault, and he is currently working on an edited book of Foucault's lectures, which will explore the ways that Foucault's lectures can be useful in educational research. Finally, he's also working on a book on how to do Foucauldian inspired genealogies. Thank you so much, David, for joining me today. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
David, just to get us started, could you begin by sharing a bit about the ways in which you engage with Foucault's work as a qualitative researcher and methodologist?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think that when I first started reading Foucault many years ago, I was in graduate school as a master's student in literature at American University, and we had a year long literary theory course that we had to take, and Foucault was actually towards the tail end of that course. And I think the first time I read Foucault, I was intrigued by his notions of disciplinarity and power and the way in which he used history. I wasn't introduced to Foucault as a qualitative researcher per se. Mm. And I was interested in Foucault because of the way in which he talked about power. But over the years, as I continued to study Foucault, I wrote a dissertation using Foucault's genealogical analytic on writing assessment. It's a book on the portfolio system in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. I've come to know Foucault as a really good fit for qualitative research. And there are many reasons for that. I think that the one is sort of anti-humanist, or his really strong kind of robust critique of humanism, his critique of the pseudosciences, particularly psychology, and the ways in which the scientificity in the human subject has sort of pervaded educational research. Mm-hmm. This idea that we can use logical positivism or any type of sort of what we might consider hard science. And Foucault really wrote about this very early on in his career in 1954 in the book Mental Illness and Psychology. He wrote about the perils of sort of the hard sciences and the soft sciences and infusing this sort of scientificity in the human subject. And I think that educational research is really, really stuck in that sort of paradigm. I mean, it's really stuck in that sort of that mode of thinking. And what's so great about Foucault is that he launches these philosophical critiques against notions of criminality and madness and sexuality, all of the sort of main ways in which we still to this day find try to determine truth about an individual and categorize them. Mm-hmm. And if we think about his work in sort of archaeology of knowledge, for example, where he talks about the anthropomorphic sleep and of course the order of things, where he talks about the death of man, that is not necessarily a sort of physical death. Obviously, it's more of a conceptual death and the ways in which we try to develop knowledge about human beings. And I think that he found that very destructive. I think he found that very disconcerting in a way. I think that the death of man is a hopeful message, in my view. And then I think his work in probably the most underutilized book of his is The Birth of the Clinic, where he talks about the sort of epistemologies of the gaze and the glance mm-hmm. to kind of seep into or get into the body. That sense of an autopsy, that medicalization of the body is still very prevalent in education, right? I mean, there is these ways in which we try to get into the mind or get into the body of the mm-hmm. of the schooled subject. And I think that The Birth of the Clinic is probably the really an important book that could be used more to, even though it's an archaeology, it's not necessarily looking at ways in which power operates, but it could be used as a way to talk about power for sure. Mm-hmm. So I think that, and then his later work, his genealogical work, for example, is been used quite a bit in qualitative research. And I think that, it's, you know, people have used it to ground, say, for example, the post-qualitative movement because of his anti-humanist position and his decentering of the subject. Mm-hmm. But I really think that the one way that I've tried to use Foucault, and I think it's also, you know, a good avenue for qualitative researchers, is to try to do genealogies. Mm. There's that famous sort of story around Jana Sawicki, who finished her dissertation, and she went to go hear Foucault talk, I believe it was at the University of Vermont, and she raised her hand in a very meek way, I think. she said, hey, I just finished writing a dissertation on your anti-humanist position, and he said, stop talking about me and do genealogies. Mm-hmm. And I think there are sort of two reasons why he, you know, advocated for all of us to do genealogies. One is that it helps us subvert, sort of taken for granted, ways of doing things in the current moment. But secondly, I think that it had a ontological, or it had some sort of personal effect on him when he did genealogies. It inspired him, or it caused him to think differently about himself and about what he thought. And I think that that point oftentimes gets lost in Foucauldian work, is that we use him in sort of this abstract sort of toolbox, and we forget that there's a person there, and that I think that there was a reason, there was something more at stake for him than just sort of abstract thinking. Mm-hmm. Foucault was very involved politically, and I think that the genealogical project for him played into or worked with or helped him with his political ambitions or political activities. So for me, I like to think of myself as a genealogist. I like to think of doing genealogies as an important way in which I can think differently about the taken for granted practices and notions of the current day practices in educational research.
Mm-hmm. David, for listeners that might not be familiar with Foucault, can you talk a little bit about what it means to do genealogies and think with genealogies?
That is such a really good question. I think that Foucault does not give us like a protocol or like a method for doing genealogical research. I think it's important to first think about who he's responding to in terms of genealogy. So for example, he's not interested in doing a progressivist history. He's not interested in showing that the past is progressing towards, or that the present, that the past is producing this march towards a better world. Foucault is not interested in that kind of progressivist mm-hmm. history. He's not interested in the sort of grand narratives that present this overall, you know, whether it be a, you know, a beautiful picture or not so beautiful picture of historical, you know, change. He's not interested in that. And he's not interested in these sort of Whiggish histories, which romanticize certain periods or certain countries. What he's more interested in is how power, knowledge moves. Mm-hmm. What he argues is that the genealogist is more of a, the genealogist diagnosis, the ways in which power knowledge moves in certain periods in time as a way to subvert or convert. Ian Hacking calls it a historical deconstruction of current taken for granted practices. And so there's always a comparison, but the comparison is not to show progression. The comparison is not to show a march. The comparison is to make, to blur what we think we know or what we think we know about the current moment or current practices. So in my own genealogical study that I wrote and published, I looked at the emergence of the portfolio. And so building on Nietzsche's work on genealogy, Foucault argues that there's sort of two approaches. There's the descent, which is not a search for an origin, but a moment in time where you go and you look back. Mm-hmm. And then there's the emergence of the portfolio as the, I say that it becomes an answer to a certain solution at the time. Mm-hmm. But what happens is that it's really about, it's not about a humanist like making students write better. It becomes a technique of power and power knowledge. So the portfolio emerges as this technique of power knowledge as a way to produce a certain type of subject. But there are genealogical threads. So power knowledge doesn't stop when you have the emergence of the portfolio. Power mm-hmm. knowledge is constantly working. Power is an action upon action. Every relationship is a power relationship. And so mm-hmm. It's not good or bad. I call it in one of the articles I recently published, it's like a capoeira dance. You know, it's a war, it's a dance, it's a game. And so power operates this way. And so part of the genealogical project is to show that the portfolio is not better or worse. It's not a humanist endeavor. Mm-hmm. It is a product, if you will, of power and power knowledge. And so you can look at different ways in which power operates. So for example, in the portfolio, you'll see that the pastoral power is operating quite heavily. Now, to look at the genealogical threads, you have to descend into the history, and you have to find a period in time where there was something similar to that, where there was a problemization around writing assessment. You know, what is that moment where there is a problemization? You also have to look at the subjugated knowledges. Like, so when, if you look at the grand narrative, so I looked at the grand narrative of secondary English education, which was, you know, Appleby's grand narrative. And where were there moments of problemization around writing assessment? Where mm-hmm. were teachers and administrators really discussing this and trying to figure that out? And I see that as sort of a battle royal of power knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And so I found this moment in Appleby's book where he talks about the laboratory method of writing. And it, to me, it resembled a portfolio. And so he also mentions an article by James Penniman as a footnote. And so I looked up the article by Penniman, and I believe it was 1892, somewhere around there. I may get my date wrong there. But and I looked at the school review as my corpus, as my, mm-hmm. my secondary corpus there. And what I found was that Appleby left out everything prior to 1900 in his book. Mm. And so I looked at the period from 1892 to 1900, as my subjugated knowledges. What I found is that School Review is a journal that was founded to talk about, to discuss issues around secondary education. And so I pulled all the articles around secondary education and writing, and then writing an assessment. And what I found in that period was that there was a complete medicalization of the body, of the secondary body, and that English and writing became tied to the logic around medicine. So there was a pathology to writing. There was a pathology and the disease around English and English education and around teaching. And teachers had to learn how to, you know, protect against the diseased language, because at that time they thought that the diseased writing or diseased thinking created disease in the body. And so I went and studied around the history of medicine to make these sort of logical assertions. And so later on I made connections to how the portfolio became actually just a more manipulative, a more insidious way in which they got into the body. And so in the 1890s, they were a little more direct around the pathology and the medicalization of the body. In the 1980s and the 1990s, when portfolios exploded, it was really laced with this sort of humanist intention. And I dismantled that, I guess, in my book, you know. And so and then I tied it to issues of neoliberalism and the like. So I think that doing genealogies is you have to think about what is Foucault responding to, what are the certain moves you can make. There are certain concepts you have to have, which are descent, emergence, subjugated knowledge, problemization. But it's about subject production, and it's about using the historical archive, and it's about looking at the machinations of power and power knowledge. Those are all really important aspects to doing a genealogy.
That's really helpful, and that was a really helpful and powerful example that you offered as well. So can you talk a little bit about your latest project with Foucault?
So I'm working on a couple projects still with Foucault. I'm still working with him. I can't believe it after all these years, but I'm still working with him. So I'm working on an edited book on the lectures that Foucault was a scholar at the Collège de France. And all of the lectures that he was required to give, a series of lectures every year. And he did so for 12 years. And he, I think 11 to 12 years, I don't remember which. But we have all the lectures are translated in English now. And so I have a collection of really brilliant authors who are each going to write on one of the lectures. So Aaron Kuntz is writing on Courage of Truth, and Tepper Britzman is going to write on the psychiatric power. I'm writing on subjectivity and truth. Michael Peters is writing on the hermeneutics of the subject. And so I think that's a really, and then Thomas Popkowitz is going to write the afterwards for it. And it's going to be, it's been such an amazing project already. And it's going to be super helpful, I think, for the educational research community. In particular, the Qual research community, because I think that the lectures don't get talked about a lot. They don't get written a lot about. I mean, I know that Michael Peters has written a lot about hermeneutics of the subject, and I have as well. And I know that Aaron has written on the Courage of Truth, and some of us are looking into them. But I think I'm hoping that the book is a fruitful, sort of, it opens up doors for people to think about how to use the lectures in their own research. So I'm working on that book, and then I'm working on a project for the data analysis series on Foucault's genealogies and how to do. I hesitate to say how to do, because Foucault was not about how to do anything really, but what are some, I call them sort of genealogical moves that you can make in terms of using history and using Foucault. So the book is, I'm using the word genealogical moves in the title. So that's another book project that I'm working on as well. And then Nelson Rodriguez and I have an edited book coming out on Foucault and friendship. In 1981, Foucault gave an interview to the Guy Pied, which is a queer rag in France at the time. and he talked about the gay rights movement and equated it to esquisses, a friendship as esquisses, that homosexuality could be a way in which one used pleasure to work on oneself, not just sexual pleasure or physical pleasure, but there are lots of pleasures in the world. And so that ties nicely in with the work that he was doing, that Foucault was doing at the time in terms of the care of the self and working on the self as a work of art. And so we have an edited book with Palgrave that's probably going to come out this year or early next year. And we have some really wonderful authors on that piece as well. So I'm very excited about the work that we're doing with Foucault and expanding and furthering his work in education.
That's really exciting. So you mentioned when you were talking about your first project, how the edited volume is one that you see is really potentially helping and forming the qualitative community. Can you talk a little bit about how you see Foucault's work informing and perhaps even pushing qualitative methodology?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I've been doing, some thinking about this lately. I think that Foucault has been used to justify, to serve as sort of grounding material for, let's say, the post-qualitative area. Mm-hmm. For because of his anti-humanism and decentering the subject, and he really helps ground the post-qualitative field. My question is really around, I'm really surprised that we haven't done more work with the four-part care of the self guidelines that he gives us. I think the end of his, he died, too young, too soon. But I think towards the end of his life, he was really trying to think about ways in which the subject or the human being navigates the world, the world of power knowledge. He's not, and I think that his ethical turn is really about, and I think about this in my own life, like what are the ways in which I practice, what are the techniques that I use, whether it be through reading or writing or exercising or dieting or the ways in which I manage my time, how is it that those things are helping me produce or create a life as a work of art? What are the ways in which power operates in my life? And power gets a bad name, and I understand it gets a bad rap. I get it. But I think from a Foucauldian perspective is that power is this force, right? Mm-hmm. So if I think of power as this force, it can shape and it can help me. I can use it to my advantage. And I think about ways in which I can, like, there are times when disciplinarity really works for me. There are times when pastorality can work. There are times when certain types of administrative powers can really work for me. And so I want to know, in terms of qualitative research or research, like, how is it that we can use, his four-part care of the self, approach to help us think through ways in which power works, but also how is it that we're producing a self as a work of art, and what does it mean to be a work of art? Like, there's a really great interview with him and the last name is Patton. And I think it recently came out, like within the last 5 years, it's just recently published, but he talks about his ethics, his inventiveness, as a refusal of these sort of grand protocols or these grand categories and this experimentation. So how can I think about my life in terms of power knowledge as a way to invent, as a way to refuse grand, like, notions of gender, for example, or notions of sexuality or notions of whatever ways in which I can categorize myself. and how can I practice be a person that practices a care of the self that tries to emulate or tries to produce as a work of art, and what might that mean? And I think that it's okay to just be in that question. So in my mind, how can qualitative research move in that direction to really engage, like seriously engage with Foucault's mission or Foucault's sort of charge to think about power knowledge as a way in which to use techniques of the self, the care of the self in my daily life, in my academic life, to produce life as a work of art. I think that's a serious and a wonderful and a sort of beautiful invitation that he gives us. I've often thought that it would be really interesting to do a study, for example, on assistant professors. Like, how is it they're shaping their lives, their care of the self? What practices or techniques of the self are they using to fashion themselves as professors? Because it's different when you're a graduate student. So what happens in that transition from being a student to the practices of the self as an assistant professor? You know, what are ways in which I think about my body? What are the ways in which I utilize pleasure or struggle as a way or challenges to fashion my life as, you know, as a professor or as a whatever it is that I'm trying to fashion myself into? You know, the fourth part is what part of myself needs to change? How am I being invited to do it? How am I doing it? And what's the telos, right? What's the goal of doing this? So it isn't based on a stabilized, essentialized subject or identity. It's what part of myself, you know, I'm different as a professor than I am as a son or as a brother or as a friend or as a, you know, in certain situations. So, and I have to fashion myself in each of those situations. And I think that there are techniques that we can really talk about and really think through. And so I would like to see some qualitative research that really takes that project seriously of like, how can I engage with power knowledge as a way in which to fashion myself, and what's my telos? Mm. And the other area, I think, again, I would say is that the issue around genealogy. I think that we need to really take that genealogical project seriously and not just use it as sort of a grounding, you know, for philosophical investigation into you know, in qualitative research. But I think that we need to take the genealogical project and really try to, you know, tackle some of these taken for granted notions of practices in education that we assume to be, you know, normal or natural or essential to education. Mm-hmm. So those are the two areas that I think the qualitative researchers can use Foucault. And I'm sure there will be more that will come out in the next couple of years.
Those are such rich starting points. So as I'm thinking about all that you've talked about and connected to Foucault's work, I'm also thinking about listeners that might not have read or engaged with anything related to Foucault, and perhaps just have heard about Foucault in passing. So for those that are new to Foucault, where would you recommend they start?
That's a really good question. And when I get asked that question, I think the most common answer I give is to start with the History of Sexuality, Part 1. Mm. And I think the reason I do that is because he lays out notions of power. Mm-hmm. But I think I might change that a little bit. And I think the one area I might start would be the Dreyfus and Robinow 1983 book. At the end of that book, there's afterwards, which is an interview with Foucault. And then there's a relatively short piece called Subject and Power. And I think I would start there because I think that he really spells out what power is. It's in those two pieces where he talks about power as an action upon action. And he spells out what genealogy is, the three aspects of genealogy. And I think that those would be two really good places to start. And then I would probably read History of Sexuality, Part One. But I'm also of the mind that I think it's really good to read authors if you're really interested in any author. And I think about this in my own work, that starting with Mental Illness and Psychologies in 1954 is a good place. And then read Madness and Civilization. And then if you really want to dive deep into Foucault, read the full dissertation that he wrote, because that's mm-hmm. out too. And then read, you know, Archaeology of Knowledge and Order of Things. It kind of go in order, in historical order, you know, and really kind of think through what his project was in terms of the archaeology, because he doesn't leave the archaeology. The archaeology is absolutely really important to the genealogy. And so I really struggled through Archaeology of Knowledge, and I'm so grateful that I did, because it helped me kind of understand what he was trying to do in terms of the genealogy or why he made that switch. And then read, you know, the Introduction to History of Sexuality, Part Two, talks about why he changed from archaeology to genealogy, and why he, what influenced him in terms of his thinking. And so that's also a good place to start too. So I don't know if that answered your question, but that's what I would say.
Yeah, those are fantastic recommendations. So David, I'm sure that many of our listeners would also appreciate accessing your work further. So what's the best way for people to learn more about your work?
They can email me, and then I can send them articles. I can give them articles to read. I would say email me or look at my ASU website would be perfect too, my profile page.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been a real pleasure to learn from you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Take care, David.
Thank you.